One is for the genetic material protein maturation, and one is amino acids and proteins. So simply starting out with the building blocks, that's the amino acids. This is a generic picture of an amino acid here, and you can see it is both an amino group and an acid group, so it's both an acid and a base. And you will notice, hopefully, I will point out. So it is a combination of an acid and a base, and it's our biological base. There's the amino group, biological acid, carboxylic acid. This is called the alpha carbon, and it's the carbon between the amino and the acid groups. And this is the side group, which is called R. And we will look at all the different side groups, which you can see in the table, are categorized for you as acidic, basic, uncharged polar, which means they're hydrophilic, and uncharged hydrophobic, or non-polar amino acids. So basically what we're going to be talking about are the R groups. So the general structure we have down now, it's an amine group and a carbon with a hydrogen, that's the alpha carbon, and then the carboxylic acid group. And the side chains then are what make the chemistry of all the different amino acids. And the first ones you see are the two acidic amino acids, aspartate and glutamate, also known as aspartic acid and glutamic acid. Those are the R groups. So remember, when you're seeing those, you have to put that on the base structure of the amino acid. Also, we will be talking only about the L amino acids. Those of you that struggle with stereochemistry, there are L and D stereochemistry. The natural amino acids, the 20 we'll talk about, are all L stereochemistry. There are no D amino acids in our endogenous proteins. D amino acids are only really interesting to peptide and protein chemists who synthesize these things outside of the body. But the body, it's all L. So we're only talking about one stereochemistry, so we won't really worry about drawing the stereochemistry. But you can see that they do have stereochemistry because everything around that alpha carbon can rotate. And that's going to become important when we move into two-dimensional, three-dimensional, and finally quaternary structure. So all L amino acids, that's the only natural amino acids. So there's 20. And if you learn them in groups, it's a little easier. You will need to know the structures of the R groups for these amino acids. You also need to know the base structure, but again, that's the same for all of them. So the amino, the alpha carbon, carboxylic acid, then you stick the R group on there. So the two acidic ones are aspartic acid and glutamic acid, hence named because they have acidic groups on them, carboxylic acid groups. They differ only by one methylene group, one CH2 group. The next grouping is the uncharged hydrophilic. These like water. And they like water because they're polar. They have some kind of polar group in them that likes hydrogen bonding. And you see asparagine and glutamine, which are the amide derivatives of aspartic acid and glutamic acid. So they look kind of similar structurally. And then you see cysteine, which is a sulfur-containing amino acid. And we mentioned sulfur as one of the elements at the very beginning in our introductory lectures, and the main sulfur that we see in the body is found in two amino acids, one of them cysteine, the other methionine, which we'll see in a minute. And then the other three have hydroxyl groups on them, and those are serine, threonine, and tyrosine. So those hydroxyl groups can participate then in hydrogen bonding, making these rather hydrophilic in nature. So these are the R groups, remember. So when you want to draw the complete amino acid for, say, serine, you'll draw the amino group, the alpha carbon, the carboxylic acid, and then you put the methylene with the OH on it. That's serine. So these are just the R groups, not the complete amino acids. And just below that, you see glycine. That's the smallest of the amino acids. That's just an H group. So on the alpha carbon, you just add an H. And it doesn't really fit all that well into any of the classes, so it kind of sits out by itself. It's certainly not particularly hydrophilic in nature. It's just very simple, very tiny amino acids. So just the H group. R is H. The basic ones, of course, would be very hydrophilic in nature. And there's three of them, histidine, arginine, and lysine. Histidine we'll see again when we talk about mechanisms of enzymes and how enzymes work. We'll see it in the catalytic triad. Has a big ability to donate and accept protons, histidine does. And we'll find that it's useful in situations where the body needs to be able to donate and accept protons, kind of like a shuttle. And arginine and lysine, again, tend to be in charge states. They have amino groups on them. Then you come down to the rest, which are kind of grouped together. And the rest tend to be more hydrophobic in nature, nonpolar. And they start with the second simplest one, which is alanine. It's just a methyl group, lysine being the simplest, just a hydrogen. Then you have leucine, isoleucine, valine. Those are all hydrocarbon structures, just kind of different isomers. Phenylalanine has a phenyl group in it. Tryptophan, you'll see there, again, it has a two-ring structure. And then you see methionine. That's the other amino acid which contains a sulfur group. But what's different between methionine and cysteine is the sulfur group in cysteine, which was just an SH, is very reactive. That's why it goes up with the hydrophilic groups. It's because those electrons on that sulfur participate in a lot of different bonds. So we're going to see cysteine as being a very reactive amino acid. Whereas methionine, because the sulfur is surrounded by carbons, it has that methyl group, it is not particularly reactive. It doesn't really do anything in terms of chemistry. The electrons on that sulfur group do not participate in a lot of different binding reactions in the body. So it goes here with uncharged nonpolar. Doesn't really participate a lot. And then the very last one there, which you see is not charged and not polar, is proline. And you'll notice the structure of proline. We actually have drawn the entire amino acid. This is the amino group. This is the alpha carbon. And this is the carboxylic acid. And the reason we had to draw the whole structure is because proline actually forms a ring. So the R group, if you will, is a methylene, a methylene, a methylene. But those three methylenes form a ring between the alpha carbon and the amine nitrogen. So proline is a cyclic amino acid. And again, proline is shown with its complete structure, not just the R group, because if we can't draw the R group, it would be very strange, because if we drew the R group, we'd just have a CH2, a CH2, and a CH2, not connected to anything. So we draw the complete structure, and again, it's forming a ring. Here's the amino group, alpha carbon, carboxylic acid. So that's our basic amino acid structure, again, amino acid. And in the case of proline, it's a ring structure. We're going to come up because of that unique structure, the ring. We're going to see it again, particularly when we talk about secondary structural features. And when we talk about how proteins fold, this one will be important because it doesn't have any flexibility. You notice here the alpha carbon's involved in a ring, so nothing can rotate. There's no rotation about that alpha carbon. Now back again to the generic structure. So you need to know the 20 natural amino acids. So you remember the generic structure is amine, alpha carbon, carboxylic acid. You can draw the amine this way where it's charged and it has hydrogens. It's fully bound, and this one's uncharged, or you can do it opposite. You can draw those however you want. You can draw this NH2, you can draw this CO2H. Unless I give you specific pKa's and pHs, you don't know whether those groups are ionized or not. So any structure, if you draw those in an ionized or unionized form, is fine. It doesn't matter unless I tell you conditions. You're not going to know that. Same is true for the R groups. Clearly, like glutamic acid, aspartic acid, lysine, they have pKa's associated with them. Well, you won't know if they're protonated or ionized unless I tell you we're at a certain pH and give you the pKa. So you can draw those however you want to. But again, there's the base structure, and it's easiest if you learn them in these groups of amino acids. Now we looked at acids and we looked at bases separately. And then we said we were going to come to the point where we would look at them together. And the reason we do that is because of amino acids. They're both amino groups and acids. And so now we can draw an ionization curve that takes into account both acid-base chemistry in one curve. And what you see here is an amino acid. And again, you kind of, it's drawn different in the stick figure. So here's the carboxylic acid group. Here's the amino group, there's the alpha carbon, and here is the R side group. So it's a CH2 with an acid group on it. So it's an aspartic acid that we have drawn there. So that's ASP, aspartic acid, that we have drawn there. And basically, it now has three ionizable groups. It's got the groups that are on the main body of the amino acid, the carboxylic acid and the amino group, and it's also got its side group, which is acidic and ionizable. So basically what we do is we take aspartic acid here and we start at a very low pH and we add base to it until we move up to a very high pH. And so at the very beginning we're at a very, very, very low pH. Everything is going to be protonated. So you notice in this structure all the groups are protonated. Both acids are protonated and the amine group is protonated. So when we look at this structure, we can find the overall charge on the structure. And we know that acids in carboxylic acids in acidic conditions have no charge, but bases, amino groups in acidic conditions have a plus one charge. So the overall charge on the molecule is plus one. Then we're going to begin to add base, and I'm going to skip all the way to the end, and then we'll come back and talk about the intermediate structures, until finally we get up here at a very high pH. Now everything is ionized. So it's exactly like we said, very low pH, everything's protonated. Very high pH, everything's ionized. So now you've got both your carboxylic acid groups and your amine group ionized. So now the overall charge on the molecule will be minus two, because now those acid groups are each carrying a minus one charge, and the base doesn't carry any charge at high pH. So those are the concepts we talked about. We talked about them separately. Now we're just combining them, and we can do the overall charge on a molecule. Now what happens in between as we add base? Basically what happens is as we cross the pKa for each of the ionizable groups, the group ionizes. So if you write that down, that will really help you. As you pass the pKa for the ionizable group, it ionizes. Once you don't know the pKa's, I'm giving them to you. And in the case of what we have here, aspartic acid, the pKa's are basically 2.1, 3.9, and 9.8. And the first pKa, the 2.1 or 2.09 pKa, is for the side group. And so that would be made very clear that the R group's pKa is 2.09. The carboxylic acid on the amino acid structure is 3.9 approximately. And the amine pKa is 9.8. So the pKa's make sense about where we think they should fall. Acids, 2, 3s, bases, 9s, 10s, 11s. So we've assigned those pKa's, and you didn't know those. Those are given. I'm telling you those. So basically, again, what happens as we go down the curve is here we're very, very acidic, pH 1. Lots of hydrogen ions around, everything's protonated, charge on the molecule is plus 1. Now as we're titrating and we're adding base, we're going to pass each of these pKa values. So we come to the first one, which is about 2.1, and again, that's the, the way it's drawn here, that's the acid group on the amino acid structure. So as we pass that, it ionizes. So exactly as we said over there, it loses its proton. So now the overall charge on the whole molecule is zero, because we have a plus one, a minus one, and a zero, which comes out to zero. We keep adding base, and finally we pass the second pKa, that's the other acid, that's going to ionize, loses its proton. Now we've got two negative charges and one positive charge, so you've got minus 2 plus 1, that makes minus 1 overall in the molecule. Now we keep adding base, keep adding base, keep adding base, till finally we're down in the basic region. We pass 9.8, that's the pKa for the amino group. It ionizes, loses its proton. Now the overall charge on the molecule is minus 2 plus 0, which is minus 2. So basically it's the exact same rules we've been saying about acids and bases separately, but now we're combining them. And that's exactly what this shows up here. Basically, as we're adding base, we're passing the pKa's, each of those groups individually ionizes. and then you can just add up the charges that you see there and find out the overall charge on the molecule. But again, you're starting out very acidic, lots of protons around, everything's protonated, and in the case of aspartic acid, that means that overall the molecule has a plus one charge. Then we pass each of the pKa's, which we've assigned now to each of the ionizable groups, and that came out of a table, not something you know, but we look it up, we can find out what's the pKa. So then we'll know, as we add base to this solution, again, the key is, the rule is, as you pass by the pKa for that ionizable group, it loses its proton. It ionizes. So that you can take any amino acid now and basically do a simple ionization curve as you move from low to high pH. And you'll actually do that in the lab. Yeah? pKa1 is corresponding to the amino acid.
Okay.
pKa2 is the side group. pKa3 is the base, the amine. And again, I would have to write that. The side group, the pKa is blah blah equal to. So again, same rules, just looks a little more complicated because we've now combined all of our theories into one nice molecule, one nice amino acid, nice combination of an acid and a base. Now, amino acids are basically the building blocks of the polymer that we call a protein. So in order to make a protein, we have to combine amino acids, put them together. Basically, the way we do that is we form an amide bond, much like we did in organic chemistry. So we take two amino acids, we do some lasso chemistry to eliminate water, and we end up with an amide bond. We don't call it an amide bond because it's a special amide bond, so we call it a peptide bond. It is just an amide bond. Its chemistry is identical to a normal amide bond, but we call it a peptide bond because it's in a protein. So basically now we've taken an aspartic acid and an alanine, we put them together and we've made this little tiny protein. So that's an amide bond. Now, once we start to put these things together, making these peptide bonds, then we can move on and talk about structure in a kind of different way. Yeah. No, it's exactly the same. Proline forms an amino acid exactly the same way. But now there'll be a ring within the protein. So here's a representative peptide. We took all of these amino acids, glutamic acid, alanine, lysine, glycine, tyrosine, and alanine. We condensed all of them, made peptide bonds, and now we have this representative, again, very tiny protein. The way the sequence of these amino acids is known as primary structure. Okay, this is the primary structure of the amino acids. So that's simply the sequence, the way they're put together. Now, let's draw one out. Draw a short one. Did I draw that thing? So if we drew it out, so if this is our representative peptide, and this is ala, af, lys, gly. Ala, af, lys, gly. You will notice that these peptide bonds, once we put a carboxylic acid and the amino group into an amide bond, it's no longer an ionizable group. There's no longer chemistry that's going to go on that. So now instead of calling these things amino acids, we call these residues. So it's just a nomenclature thing. Once we put them into a protein, they're residues now. And their carboxylic acid and amine groups are no longer part of the chemistry. So the main part of the chemistry of the protein now is going to come from the R groups, from the side chains. So the side chains are still ionizable. Side chains can still participate in forming salt bridges or ion bonds or hydrogen bonding or a variety of different things that we'll talk about with each other. So that's why the R groups are so important, because once we make a protein, we no longer really care about the amino and the carboxylic acid group. We only care about the side chains, the R groups. So that's why we class them into different chemistries, because that will become important now as we look at what proteins do and what they're capable of. When we draw a protein, we always put the N-terminus on the left and the carboxyl on the right. That's just standard so that we can all talk to each other. That way I can draw using three-letter codes or one-letter codes, and every other chemist or biochemist knows that the amino end is on the left and the carboxy terminus is on the right. So that's just a standard, kind of like IUPAC nomenclature that you learned in organic chemistry. That's how we draw proteins in biochemistry. Always N on the left, carboxyl on the right. Now you need to convince yourself, this is kind of a thing when you go home, that those two peptides are not equivalent. It matters which way I write the sequence. So primary structure being the sequence matters. Alla, ast, lice, gly is not gly, lice, ast, alla. You can't turn them around. So draw that one out when you get home, gly, lice, ast, alla, and you see it doesn't look like this one. So sequence is important. That's primary structure, sequence. Residues, R groups. R groups are important because they lead to secondary structure. Secondary structure. There are lots of types of secondary structure, but we're only going to look at two of them. If you got into peptide or protein chemistry, you will find a lot more secondary structural elements, but the primary two that we're going to look at are the alpha helix and the beta sheet. An alpha helix is pretty much like you think about in DNA and RNA. It's a spiral. The R groups point outwards, and the average alpha helix in proteins is about 3.6 amino acid residues per turn. There's a couple of exceptions which we'll talk about on Wednesday. So 3.6 amino acid residues per turn. The helix is stabilized by intra-chain hydrogen bonding. And the amino acid, the special one, the ring structure proline, is known as a helix breaker. So if you're running along in structure in a sequence in a protein and you've got a nice spiral alpha helix and you hit a proline, that will end the alpha helix. And the reason is proline can't bend and fit itself into an alpha helix. Because remember, there's no rotation about that alpha carbon in a proline. It's rigid. So the rigidity basically stops that secondary structure there, and we change to some other type of secondary structure. So it's known as a helix breaker. The helixes can be left or right-handed. Don't worry about that. Same in DNA and RNA. We're not going to look at them from the above view and try to figure out if they're right or left-handed, but they can be both. Notice the cartoon structures. You'll see those in the literature. They're all three ways of representing an alpha helix. Usually you'll just see it as a kind of a tube structure. And that means alpha helix. The other most common type, and again there are many more of secondary structures, is beta sheet. So say you hit a proline as you're running along. You break the alpha helix and then you start some beta sheet structure. Beta sheet structure is very different than an alpha helix. It's kind of a flat, extended arrangement. And it's stabilized by interchain rather than intrachain hydrogen bonding. And The beta sheets can be parallel or anti-parallel. Again, we're not going to worry too much about that, but they can run along in the same direction or opposite directions in the structure. And there's lots of other structural features like beta turns, different kinds of turns. There's structure that's not describable. It's just kind of, we don't know, doesn't really fit into any kind of category. But remember, we're talking about proteins that are very, very big. These little proteins that we've drawn are very tiny. We're just using it as an example. We're talking about hundreds and thousands of amino acid residues. And so they first have primary structure. They're all linked in a certain sequential fashion. And then the next thing they do is they fold and get some sort of secondary structure. Now, the very last thing that happens is they get tertiary structure. Some of them get quaternary, but most proteins stop at tertiary structure. And tertiary structure is basically the folding into a three-dimensional shape. So it's the complete entire folding picture, if you will, of the protein. And most of the tertiary structure is based on the hydrophobic effect. So it's based on those first things we talked about when we first came together, which is things being hydrophilic and hydrophobic. So all of those residues now that have a sequence, they have primary structure. They have some alpha helix, some beta sheets, some nondescript areas. Now, they all come together to make one giant three-dimensional structure, and it's basically based on like attracts like. So the hydrophilics tend to want to be near each other, and the hydrophobics like to be near each other, and usually in the interior, so that they're far away from water as they can get. Remember, all these things are, of course, sitting in water because that's our biological solvent. So the hydrophobic effect is very powerful in protein structure. It makes them make this kind of three-dimensional structure. And again, in the literature, you'll see that the structures often look like that, kind of tubes and different cartoony-like shapes, because you're trying to represent a huge molecule in a kind of three-dimensional way. Now, some proteins, not very many, go on and form one more type of structure, and that's quaternary structure. And the best example of quaternary structure is a hemoglobin molecule. And you will notice that immediately following exam one, we are going to talk in detail about hemoglobin, myoglobin, and gas transport. And basically what happens, and this is a picture of hemoglobin, is that for quaternary structure, you take two or more complete proteins that have primary, secondary, and tertiary structure, and you combine those together to make one giant functional protein. So hemoglobin is not functional. In other words, it can't pick up oxygen in your lungs and deliver it to your tissues, which is what it does, unless it has two alpha subunits and two beta subunits, and each of the alphas and each of the betas is a complete entire protein on its own. It has primary structure, secondary structure, tertiary structure, and it actually has a heme group, a prosthetic group in it, which we'll talk about. You don't need to worry about that now. But each one is a total protein on its own, but you don't get a hemoglobin unless all four come together. So that's very complex structure. That's quaternary structure. And we'll look at it again in more detail after the first exam when we look at hemoglobin, myoglobin, gas transport. So not all proteins have that. But hemoglobin is an excellent example of it. Yeah?
When you measure a protein, what structure is it showing?
Your tertiary and secondary. You're opening it up, flattening it out so you can sequence it usually. So yeah, when you denature something, you're trying to break all its hydrophobic interactions, break any disulfide bonds, which we'll talk about on Wednesday, or bonds between the sulfurs and cysteine groups. Trying to break apart all its structure so it'll lie out flat, and then you can figure out its sequence, how its amino acids are put together. So hemoglobin, nice example. Nice example comes with a little clinical correlate that emphasizes the importance of primary structure. And the clinical correlate is the disease sickle cell anemia. We won't get greatly into the disease, but to appreciate that normal hemoglobin, adult hemoglobin, is made up of, again, the two alphas and the two betas. Well, there can be a mutation, and we're going to talk about mutations next because we're going to talk about what happens on the genetic level. And in a normal beta structure, there is a glutamic acid on the beta protein. And if something goes wrong with the codons, the messenger RNA, and the whole transfer, and that glutamic acid becomes a valine, Remember, glutamic acid now is a hydrophilic acidic R group, and it becomes a valine, which is hydrophobic. It's a hydrocarbon group. Then that changes the whole shape of the hemoglobin molecule, the whole structure of the hemoglobin molecule. You will notice that normally it's very plump. If you look back up at the one above, it kind of has a kind of, I don't know, a better word, a kind of plumpness to it. It's very round, kind of soft, and it fits all through the vessels, arteries, veins, etc., very nicely. Okay, it flows nicely. Well, when this one amino acid, this one, the sequence now, primary structure, glutamic acid becomes a valine, it changes the whole way the thing folds. So the hydrophobic effect is affected, clearly, because we're changing something from very hydrophilic to very hydrophobic, and you get an abnormal patch on the surface, and what happens is they sickle, the hemoglobin sickle, hence it's called sickle cell. They form little kind of rod-like structures, so they're no longer nice and plump. And of course, that makes them clump and makes them thick and causes all kinds of problems with them flowing, and hence then come all the different symptoms and clinical problems that one sees with sickle cell disease, which is not, we're not going to go into the real clinical stuff, but there's a lot of pain associated with it, a lot of problems. And it comes from that sickling, but again, the point being, one little mutation, glutamic acid to valine, gives an idea of the importance of the sequence of the R groups and of whether the R groups are hydrophilic or hydrophobic, and so then the way they interact together, making the shape, the secondary and tertiary structure, and in this case, quaternary, because we're talking about hemoglobin. So it's really critical how the sequence goes, all the way from primary, secondary, tertiary structure. All the sequences are very important. Now I'm going to throw you a little bit because I'm going to go into a lecture that you don't have in front of you, which is okay. We won't panic. It is nucleotide composition and structure. And the reason I'm opening that up is because I want to go through this nice little overview. So write that down, nucleotide composition and structure. We're going to cover this later in the semester. That's where this picture is. I need to move this picture into pretty much all of the genetic material because it's a really nice overview picture. And it shows you basically what we're going to look at when we look at the genetic level. And basically what we're going to look at is DNA going to RNA becoming proteins. That's basically the whole kind of, in a nutshell, the key to genetics. The rest of the picture, you can see DNA. So there's DNA we start with. It replicates, it can repair itself, it goes through recombination. So that's DNA, and we're going to look at those processes, what happened to it. It can be restructured and rearranged. And there's something called a heterochromatin and euchromatin, and we'll get into the details of that. But basically, then what happens is transcription. So you have translation, transcription, or no, not translation, but you have rearrangement, restructuring. Then you have transcription, then processing, then translation. Finally, we end up with a protein out of all of this, and then the protein can actually be processed into something functional. So it's kind of the steps that happen at a genetic level. So we're talking about the nucleus of the cell. We're talking about nucleic acids, why we cared about RNA, DNA, why it's a class of a biomolecule. It's because basically that's where all of these proteins begin. It's where they all begin. And that's where the mistake that happens in people with sickle cell occurs. Okay, so it's a mutation that occurs up at this level, and the mutation is we end up getting a valine instead of a glutamic acid. So we're going to talk about how we start with DNA and what happens to it and how it can be mutated and how the body fixes most of the mutations, how it's transcribed, it's processed into messenger RNA, then finally the codons are translated into a protein, and then the protein is made functional in some way. So again, this picture is not going to be on the exam or anything, but nice introductory picture if you want to take a look at that. So, the process of protein synthesis and maturation, it kind of goes along with what we're talking about, because we're talking about amino acids, talking about how amino acids form peptide bonds, and how they become primary structure sequence, secondary structure, alpha helix, beta sheet, tertiary structure, the hydrophobic effect, the whole protein is folded, and then some proteins go on with quaternary structure. So again, the flow for genetic information is DNA to RNA to protein. So the DNA encodes all the information, it stores it, the genetic material, for the synthesis of all the proteins. And then a copy of that encoded information is transcribed and processed into what's called messenger RNA. And then the messenger RNA carries out the direction of the protein or directs the synthesis of the protein. And that's called translation. And translation is occurring on the surface of particles in on something called ribosomes, and we'll talk about those. So to start it all out, we have what we call the genetic code, something you've all heard about. And basically what the genetic code is a system of specific base sequences that specify all 20 of the natural amino acids. So it's these codes, these little codons, this genetic code that's used to make proteins. So the genetic code is comprised of codons, and what you see in front of you there are codons, lots of codons. Do not memorize the codons. Do not need to memorize the codons. So the genetic code is comprised of codons, and the codons are triplets of bases which specify a certain amino acid, a specific amino acid. There are 64 codon sequences that exist, and 61 specify amino acids, and 3 direct the termination of translation. Now, since there are only 20 naturally occurring amino acids that we just talked about, there's more than one codon for each amino acid. Because clearly, if we have 61 coding for amino acids, we only need 20 natural amino acids, there's more than one. For example, if you look at the amino acid isoleucine, I-L-E, there's 3 codons for isoleucine, ATT, ATC, and ATA. So those are our bases that are being coded: adenine, thymine, cytosine, guanine, and uracil will come into the picture in a minute. So for example, what you will notice is these codons are synonyms, they're synonymous, that's the word that's used, and you'll notice that the only place that they differ is at the third base. The third base. So the synonymous codons, or the synonyms, differ only in the third base. And what that means is that the genetic code is what's called degenerate. They call it degenerate because it has synonymous codons that vary only in the third base pair. There are 3 codons which are not listed here that are the stop ones that tell everything to stop. Those are TAA, TAG, and TGA. And those are known as also as nonsense, either nonsense or stop codons. So when we come along as we're going down a chain of codons and we hit those, that ends translation. So when it hits something that's nonsense that makes no sense to it, a stop codon, it will stop. Now pretty much, and not completely everything, but almost all translation begins with one codon, and that's AUG. AUG specifies the codon for methionine. So once we find the AUG, we can read the whole rest of the message one codon at a time. So we can actually take a pencil and mark out 3, 3, 3, 3 base pairs, and then read using our little translator here, which of course is all computerized now, tell us the amino acid sequence until we encounter the nonsense codon, which is when we stop. When we stop. Yeah. The genetic code is DNA. These are DNA codons. And for example, if we take the DNA sequence that's in your notes there, 5' to 3' sequence, the first thing that happens is it has to be transcribed into messenger RNA. And the only difference is thymine becomes uracil, so T becomes U. Otherwise, there's no difference in these codons. There's no difference in the genetic code. So in DNA, the U's are T's. In RNA, the T's are U. So as you look at that sequence, you can use your pencil and mark off sets of 3 there, and then compare it to the RNA, the messenger RNA sequence, 5' to 3', and you'll notice the only difference then is that we have U's in there instead of T's. Then basically we can take the sequence that you see here, the messenger RNA sequence, and use our little converter here and translate it into this very tiny protein, which is methionine, glycine, glycine, tyrosine, proline. And so you should look at that in detail and use this little chart and make sure that you can see that it's methionine, glycine, glycine, tyrosine, proline, nonsense or stop codon would come then. So that's our little tiny example of how we make a very little tiny protein. Very little tiny. And again, notice it's starting with methionine, the AUG codon, which is how most of them start. So again, you don't need to memorize the list of codons, but you should be able to look at the list of codons and look at this little example and see how that works. Now, for all of for translation to occur, the amino acids have to be activated. So this whole reaction sequence doesn't just happen by itself, the peptide bond formation. And so the activation is for two reasons. It ensures the correct amino acids recognized, and it provides the energy that we need to make the protein. And what activation is basically covalently coupling the amino acid to some kind of adapter or activating molecule. So that's what we mean by activating. We're coupling the amino acid to some kind of adapter or activator molecule. And those activator or adapter molecules are called transfer RNA. And there's at least one tRNA for each of the 20 natural amino acids. And the tRNAs are recognizing the codons, which are being carried by the messenger RNA. And then they position themselves, they kind of get ready, if you will, when the messenger RNA comes through, to facilitate the peptide bond formation. Don't really worry about these reactions. It gives you some examples of what's going on. Particularly don't worry about this kind of ugly looking drawing here, which is really getting heavily into genetics. But notice that we use high energy phosphate bonds to provide energy for translation to occur. That's kind of the key. The key is that the peptide bonds don't just form by themselves. We need some kind of helper molecule and adapter, and that's known as transfer RNA. And there's one for each of the 20 amino acids. And it comes and sets itself up near the messenger RNA and recognizes the codons to facilitate the amide bond or peptide bond formation. Now, if you look down at the structure of tRNAs, again, it's not something you want to get really worried about because it's kind of complicated looking. It is kind of complicated. They're all very kind of similar in structure, so they have a lot of their structure is pretty much the same in each one. And so they have only one region that's really highly variable. And that region varies so that there's one for each of the 20 natural amino acids. And basically what happens is this is occurring at the ribosome, on the ribosome, which is where the protein synthesis is occurring. And they set them up, each tRNA sets up kind of along with the messenger RNA and provides the energy in terms of high energy phosphate bonds to facilitate the peptide bond formation. And that's really the take-home message. Don't get wrapped up in the structures. You can look at them and you can kind of see the codon there, 5 prime to 3 prime, and there it is kind of already. And then you've got an anticodon. There's a lot of technical terms like wobble and so on that you don't need to worry about. Ribosomes. What are ribosomes? They're found in the cytoplasm. And they're basically on the outer face of the endoplasmic reticulum and in the mitochondrial matrix. And they're basically kind of balls of protein that are made of RNA and proteins. RNA and proteins. And there's different kinds of ribosomes, but the eukaryotic ribosomes, which of course are the cells we're talking about, have two subunits, a big one and a small one. And the big subunit, which is called titled 60X, has about 45 proteins and about 3 ribosomal RNAs in it. And the smaller one has about 33 proteins and about 18 ribosomal RNAs. So basically they're balls of protein and RNA. There are also mitochondrial ribosomes, so those are the cytoplasmic ribosomes. And the mitochondrial ribosomes are also comprised of a big and a small subunit, and you don't need to worry about really the details of the size of the subunits. Just know that ribosomes are kind of balls of protein and RNA. That's what they look like. They kind of look like round structure balls. So for protein synthesis to occur, we need translation of messenger RNA, and that requires ribosomes, the messenger RNA, and the transfer RNA, which gives us the energy. It also requires a number of exogenous factors, different things, kind of like foods that we need. And the energy, again, is coming in the form of high-energy phosphate bonds from ATP and GTP. And there's three steps that happen in translation, three major steps. We initiate it, so we start the protein synthesis. We elongate the protein, adding amino acids, and then terminate, end the synthesis. So we initiate, we elongate, and we terminate. And we're going to talk about each of those processes, initiation, elongation, and termination, and then talk about some of the translational inhibitors, particularly antibiotics, things that will stop this process from occurring. But we'll stop for today, and we'll go back. We'll come back to this and talk about these, so bring this lecture. And also what we'll talk about on Wednesday is we're going to get in now to different types of proteins. There are different types, so we're going to talk about all the types. Fibrous, membrane, globular, the different types of proteins.